This is Fresh Air. Going to the movies hasn't been quite the same since Pauline Kael retired from The New Yorker. One of the pleasures of movie-going was coming home and reading what she had to say about the film. Kael describes what got to her about a film, why it moved her or made her laugh, or why she thought it was phony. She separates great performances from the merely pretentious. And you read her not just to find out what she thinks, but because her writing is so entertaining. She is perhaps the contemporary critic who has most influenced other critics. Kael is 72, and after 24 years with The New Yorker, she retired from regular reviewing earlier this year. Her last book of New Yorker movie reviews has just been published. It's called Movie Love. And her book of capsules, 5001 Nights at the Movies, has just been updated. We called her earlier today at her home in Western Massachusetts. She told me the editor of The New Yorker, William Shawn, hired her because he wanted the movie reviews to be more daring. Nevertheless, she had to fight to keep her slangy, colloquial style.
My daughter said that I spent more time and energy of restoring what I'd written than I had writing it. Sure, it was tough. The New Yorker has a more genteel tone than I wanted or that I could naturally have. I wanted to be truthful to the experience of movies. What, you know, we make friends and we date in terms of our movie responses. I wanted to get at that and to get away from the academic tone of movie reviewing. And yes, it was hard at first, but gradually the people there not only liked what I was doing, but you know, were incredibly kind about it. Initially, they resented my voice. One New Yorker writer wrote me a note saying that I should get my dirty cowboy boots out of the pages of the magazine.
What kinds of things would you have to restore in your writing after they were edited out?
Well, initially, even contractions, just saying I'm rather than I am, would be changed. Almost every contraction, almost every slang term. The funniest time, I think, was when I described something as being like a banana split, and the editor suggested I change it to Puss Cafe. It just, I think gradually in The New Yorker got a kind of snotty tone. It really could use a dose of multiculturalism. It needs it badly still. Every time I read a book review in The New Yorker, I groan and I want to tear it up. There's something about those book reviews, they never make you want to read the book.
So in those earlier days at The New Yorker, when you really had to fight to save your own voice, your colloquial voice, how would you do it? What was your, you know, if your stuff was getting changed in the editing process, how would you restore it to what you wanted?
I simply restored it every time. I mean, it took a lot of effort, and gradually, William Shawn had made me a promise that he would never change a word without consultation, and he did stick to that. But this editing process, he just took as the normal part of writing for The New Yorker. And so it took several years before I persuaded him not to subject me to it.
So every time you wrote a review, they would take out the contractions and you'd restore them? I mean, you'd go
That's
through
right.
this every time?
That's right. I wrote an incredible amount on the margins of the galleys. And also, some of the sub-editors would take out paragraphs that they thought were too strongly stated, and I would restore those. Or they would rewrite a sentence, and I would restore that. It took incredible effort and patience. It drove me crazy. I was eager to run out to see a movie that I wanted to cover the next week, and I was busy trying to remember what I'd actually written.
Were you ever surprised by what actually made it into print?
Sometimes, but there were battles that I lost. And that continued under Robert Gottlieb. I lost a couple of battles in the last few years. I think that happens with every editor. Editors feel it's their magazine and they want it to sound in the way they think appropriate. And they're particularly nervous about a woman using strong language and in a critical column. If I were a fiction writer, I could say things that they won't allow me to say in a critical piece. And I understand that, but I've battled like hell to try to get past it. And I think most of the time I've won.
If you're just joining us, Pauline Kael is joining us. And she, by the way, has two new collections that are out. She has a book called Movie Love, and that's her collection of reviews from The New Yorker from 1988 to 1991. But she also has a revised, updated version of 5001 Nights at the Movies, which is capsule reviews of over 5,000 films. So we're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Film critic Pauline Kael is joining us on the phone. You retired from The New Yorker earlier this year, and I know some people have something of an identity crisis when they retire because they're no longer doing what everyone defined them by. Has that been a problem at all for you?
It's hell. I wanted to retire. I felt physically I couldn't go on. And yet, of course, it's difficult. I mean, I do write the reviews in my head. I knew that I would start repeating myself. I knew it was physically too tough. I mean, I'm 72. It was time to stop. But it's awfully tough, sure. I won't deny that. I love the leisure and the freedom, but when I see something like, oh, Juliet Stevenson's performance in Truly, Madly, Deeply, I want to write about her acting. And it's defeating not to have an outlet. When I see the sort of comedy that Emma Thompson does, I want a chance to write about it. And I've got to get used to doing something else. But yes, it is tough.
How did you choose the moment to retire?
Well, it's a little personal. I think it was the last big review in the book is Awakenings. And I have Parkinson's myself, which is one of the things that made it difficult going to screenings in the city. Because sometimes waiting outside a theater on opening day for a movie, particularly in the winter, my body would stiffen and become rather painful. And I realized it was time to quit. When it began to be agonizing just to get into a movie, it was time to knock off.
How is your health now?
I feel great. One of the things you can do when you're not making deadlines is take better care of yourself. And so I really feel very good. And I'm thinking about things I want to write. I prepared these two books for publication, which took a lot of hell. I mean, 5001 Nights is a 945-page book, which is a form of insanity to try to proofread and index. But I keep finding mistakes that drive me crazy now. No matter how meticulous you are, no matter how many friends you ask to read it and go over it, you still keep finding mistakes. But that took a lot of time and energy. Now I've got to think about things to read. One of the great things about retiring is you have a chance to read the books you didn't get a chance to read before. I've been catching up on books that I meant to read for years. I finally read a wonderful book that I've been thinking about since the mid-'80s, Her First American by Laurie Siegel. Now I read books and think what great movies they would be. That's an absolute natural for Paul Mazursky. I'm amazed he hasn't discovered it. And I keep thinking in terms of movies into books. I keep thinking about performances. So something will come of it. I mean, some kind of writing will come of it because I love writing so much.
William Shawn, the former editor at The New Yorker who brought you to the magazine, wrote the introduction to your book 5001 Nights at the Movies, and he praises you for everything in the introduction, but concludes by saying, "What she is primarily is a writer. One reads her for the sheer pleasure her writing affords." Are there things that you've wanted to write beyond movie criticism that you couldn't get to because of the deadlines and your commitment to The New Yorker?
I did early in my life. By the time I started writing movie criticism, I realized that that was my form. I mean, there's very little I haven't been able to bring into my movie reviews. I've used everything I've got in the reviews, I think. And no, I haven't wanted to do other forms since. Somehow it became satisfying. Maybe it was a compromise form at the beginning because I wanted to write plays. I wanted to write all sorts of things. I wanted to direct movies. But by the time I was in my 30s and 40s, I realized that I was a movie critic and that I was good at that. And that was satisfying in a way that the other things perhaps weren't. I don't think I ever took the same pleasure in other forms of writing that I took in movie criticism.
Did you always know how to work in the rest of the world into your reviews? I mean, because within your reviews, you can find social criticism, personal anecdotes that have happened to you, just like small things that you'll work in, you know, like...
Well, it came in automatically, instinctively. I never think out a review before I write it. I mean, now when I think them out in my head, that's something else because I know I'm not going to write them. But when I sat down to write, you know, it was a matter of picking up the pencil and seeing where my head took me. I'm not an outliner or a pre-organizer. I'm much more of a jazz improviser. I love to see where the pencil's going to take me. And it's fun when I get to the end because sometimes I had no idea I was going to take that circuitous route and go through so many things. But it's the fun of writing to sort of dare yourself to go wherever the pencil takes you.
You've referred in the past to how you've sometimes been kept out of screenings as punishment for writing a bad review, and they wanted to keep you away from this new movie. What kind of circumstances has that happened under?
It's been very general. It's one of the reasons I've had to wait on the street in cold weather to get into movies on opening day. I mean, in some cases, it's studios that never invite me to their movies because I've just not been very kind to their movies in the past. In some cases, it's the directors who don't want me to see their movies early. They think I'm going to influence other critics. I don't talk to other critics. I mean, they wait until the reviews are out if they want to know what I think. But there's some mythology, some fantasy that somehow I have some power organization and that I've got a network of critics waiting to see what I think so they'll know what to write. It's nonsense. If that were the case, I'd be much more in accord with other people's reviews. But the studios love to traffic in rumors. They love to think that somebody's going to influence the public against them, and they better keep that person out. In a way, it's a tribute, but it's a hell of an inconvenience.
Well, when you felt that you were being kept out of a screening, did you call up and try to get yourself invited?
They tell you they'll let you see the movie when they want to. They're very bold and crude.
Right, so they're that blunt about it.
Oh, yes, yes, it's very blunt. And sometimes it's very painful when you've got a deadline and you want to write about a particular film and everybody's already covered that film and they still won't let you in to see it. Fortunately, I write rather fast, and so I can go on opening day. But a great many readers would write and ask why my reviews were so much later than other people's. Well, the answer was, I didn't see the movie when Time and Newsweek saw it. They saw it months early. I saw it on opening day.
Right. When you retired from The New Yorker, you said you would continue to write occasional pieces. What kinds of stuff? Have you been working on anything?
I keep making notes, and I'm not sure yet what I want to write about. It's difficult. I'm interested in things like the way dating and movies go together.
Well, that is interesting, and it's always something you've been getting at in the titles of your books.
That's
too.
That's right, and it's a particular problem for a woman because men often humor you in a condescending way if you like something that they don't respond to. I think almost all young women have this resentment when they've responded to something, and the date, particularly if he paid for the ticket, you know, sort of laughs at them condescendingly. He's laughing at your extravagance of emotion sometimes, and it drives you crazy with frustration. And I think as we grow older, if we're lucky, we make friends sometimes in terms of their tastes in movies and in the other arts, because it's just too frustrating. I mean, friendship and taste go together. It's almost... Well, it's almost inconceivable to me to have friends who don't respond to some of the things I respond to. I don't expect them to respond to everything, God knows. But if they don't respond to some of the things, you've got no real basis for friendship.
Were some of your early experiences at the movies on dates?
Oh, sure. Almost all of them, once I got past my early years. Once I got to be about 16, sure, movies and dating went together, and often I broke up with kids I went with because of we disagreed so violently about movies. Or they didn't understand my responses. They thought I was over-responding, that I was going overboard on something. And there's an incredible anger you can feel when you know that something moves you deeply and when somebody poo-poos it. I developed a hatred of one kid I went out with because he didn't respond to Dido and Aeneas, the music, as strongly as I did, and he thought I was just making a mistake. I broke up with someone over West Side Story because he thought it was wonderful, a classic. I mean, those are the you know, pitfalls of growing up.
Well, I love this idea for the piece. Pauline Kael, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Pauline Kael's new collection of reviews is called Movie Love, and she has a new edition of her book of capsule reviews, 5001 Nights at the Movies. This is Fresh Air.